game. You know, he had a good half, you know, and against South Carolina, but also, you know, took a safety, made a couple turnovers. It hasn't been the complete performance. And that's what I boil Alabama down to, is like, they're not going to make the playoff if Jalen Milroe does not enter hero mode the rest of the way. And the way he's played the last three games, it's like, you know, still a decent quarterback, but not hero mode quarterback. And that's who they need, because they just don't have the defense. They don't have the playmakers at other positions. They can't run it down your throat with the running backs and the offensive line they got. And so at some point, I think Alabama is suffering that third loss. I don't know if it's going to be this week against Missouri. I think they probably handle Missouri. Although
I know this, unless Eli is really channeling his inner Lane and trolling.
Yeah.
If Drew Pine's playing, I find it hard to believe Missouri has a path to winning that game.
Yeah, I think Alabama does take care of some business this week, but then the November 9th game, I believe it is, at Baton Rouge. You know, LSU is the exact type of team that I think could give Alabama fits. And LSU, while I'm still reserving a little bit of judgment, like, they look like a team that's getting better, and Alabama looks like a team that's getting worse. So I think that third loss is coming for Bama, and I think it's going to be, you know, oh my gosh, the sky is falling. And I think that's overly dramatic. That's college football for you. That's Alabama football for you. But I mean, I think if we would have taken a straw poll among rational people a week after Nick Saban retired, I think the most common response you would have got is Kalen DeBoer will go 9-3 in year one. And I think that's probably where they're going to finish. And Alabama fans will freak out, but I think it probably reflects what he inherited. He inherited like a 9-3 team.
He inherited a 9-3 team. We did not probably have on our bingo card that one of the wins would be Georgia and one of the losses would be Vandy. But I think you're right. And that gets us to this weekend's big game. It is for first place in the SEC. We've got LSU at A&M, and I'm with you. I think every single week Doug's son, Garrett Nussmeier, continues to get better. I think the defense is improving. But this is a little bit different test than what they've seen. A&M's front is going to definitely be able to challenge them. LSU hasn't been great in the red zone. How do you see this one? How do you see this one shaping out?
I kind of give a slight lean to Texas A&M. It was kind of weird on our podcast this week. I picked Texas A&M to win the game, but I took the 2.5 points in LSU. So I'm trying to thread the needle.
You want a little insurance?
Yeah, one of the little insurance. So it does feel like kind of a, you know, a razor's edge type of game, but I'm one of those people that, like, I can't shake what I saw from A&M against Missouri. And I know they haven't been that dominant since then, although they haven't lost. They haven't need to be that dominant. But, like, this, much like LSU, feels like a team that's getting better. I just feel like when both teams are at their best, I think A&M's a little bit more well-rounded. Like, I like A&M's defense better than LSU's, even though I agree LSU's defense, you know, certainly an improvement upon last year. And there's a strange case that can be made, whether coincidence or not, the defense looks better without Harold Perkins.
Yeah.
And that's a head-scratcher. But I like A&M's defense better than LSU's. I like A&M's run game better than LSU's. Slight lean on quarterback and wide receivers on LSU, but you know, all things being equal, I think A&M's a little bit more well-rounded. They're at home. I actually think the Kyle Field home field advantage is a little bit overrated.
You and me both, brother.
But them being the home team, that feels like it's worth a couple points maybe. So it does feel like to me a game that could be like a 24-22 type of game, a 31-30 type of game. I think it's going to be close. And I don't think, you know, the reaction is going to be to say, like, loser goes home, right? And maybe the loser does miss the playoffs. But I still think there's a path for the losing team to have a shot. You know, you look at what LSU has left. I think LSU would probably be favored in every game it has remaining. Doesn't mean it's going to win them all, but there's still a shot. For Texas A&M, if they can get to that Texas game with two losses, then have all the emotion, the rivalry fuel, the game at Kyle Field. Maybe Texas feels like they're in at that point if they're sitting on one loss and A&M would need to win it. Like, I don't think the loser is eliminated, but I think the winner is in great shape to make the playoff, as long as they can kind of avoid disaster at that point. So it does feel like a play-in game for the winner. I don't know that it's totally an elimination game for the loser.
We're wrapping up here with Blake Topmeyer here. Of course, he is the senior national columnist for college football for USA Today. All right, Texas goes to Nashville. If Diego could do this, like, I don't even know, like, I've always said this, like, I don't even want to give him the Heisman. Like, I just want to, I want to make a new award for him, for just, like, the ultimate baller award. But is there any chance that we get into the fourth quarter and everybody's having to flip over because this is actually still a game?
I think it could be a game in the fourth quarter. I think a Vanderbilt upset would shock me, although I've been shocked before this season with teams they beat. So, but yeah, I mean, I think it could be a game in the fourth quarter. I think Vanderbilt's like sneaky pretty good. Like I keep waiting for them to reveal themselves like, oh, they're Vanderbilt. And like, you know, I don't think this is a 9-3 Vanderbilt team. I don't think it's an 8-4 Vanderbilt team, but it could be a 7-5 Vanderbilt team. And like, I just don't think there's anybody that horrible in the SEC this year. And I don't think, other than, you know, maybe one or two exceptions, like when Georgia plays at their best, like they're really, really good. I don't know if I would even use the word elite with Georgia, but they're really, really good. But I think that, and we were kind of getting at this earlier, like the terrible teams have sort of faded away. Now, Greg Sankey would use that as an argument of like, oh, well, the SEC needs 5 or 6 playoff teams. I don't know if that's true either. Like, I don't think they have a lot of great teams, but they don't have a lot of horrible teams either. So, and yeah, to your point on the Heisman, and everybody votes differently that has a Heisman ballot, I don't freak out about that. Like, I kind of have the stance of like, your ballot, your choice. But the way I approach Heisman voting is with my number one and number two spots on my ballot, I try to vote the two players that I thought were the two best players in the nation. That's who's getting my number one and number two votes. The third spot on my ballot, I use it to vote for a player who I think had a very, very good season, and I enjoyed the heck out of watching. And were they actually the number three best player in college football? Maybe not. But it's my ballot. It's my choice. And so, like, Pavia could be that type of player. Now, he's got to play well second half of the season. If it falls apart for him, I'm not giving him a courtesy vote. But if he plays well the second half of the season, has some good numbers, he's been one heck of a lot of fun to watch, hey, maybe he finds a spot on my ballot, because that's kind of the way I approach it. And everybody hand wrings over how people Heisman vote. I mean, I think if people have decided you get a vote, you get to vote however you want, and that's sort of how I do it.
No, I'm with you. It's your vote, your choice. All I ask is that you actually watch college football.
Yeah, that is important. I don't like that some people have a ballot that they seem to start watching the season about middle of November, and they hadn't seen anything that happened the first 10 weeks of the year.
Conference championship time. Guess I'll fire that's up some right. college football. All right, buddy, safe travels.
Okay, sounds good.
That is Blake Topmeyer, SEC, or beg your pardon, now national senior college football columnist for the USA Today Sports Network. We come back, let's get into the list. We'll update you on some NFL news, who will be playing, who won't be playing this week. Also, maybe want to take a look at the World Series, which begins tonight. We'll do all that when we come back, right here on Jeffrey Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Our friends over at Robert Irwin Jewelers are having a huge 47th anniversary sale, and it ends this weekend. So hurry on over to one of their 5 local locations and take advantage, where you can get 47% off one item in stores, or you can buy one, get one free. You can buy a 2-carat lab-grown diamond tennis bracelet for only $15.99 and get a pair of half-carat diamond studs for free. You can also buy a 5-carat lab-grown diamond tennis bracelet for only $27.99 and get a pair of 1-carat diamond studs for free. Also, you can get a 10-carat lab-grown diamond tennis bracelet for only $49.99 and get a 2-carat pair, or I should say a pair of 2-carat diamond studs for free. It's the RIJ way to celebrate 47 years of making memories happen. They also have lots of financing options, so you can give, that gives you the amount of time to get it now and give it in time for the holidays. Bigger, brighter diamonds, better prices, all at Robert Irwin Jewelers, 5 locations, or shop online at rijewelers.com. Eric Hasseline going to join us to preview Grizzlies and Rockets tonight, also the Grizzlies' home opener tomorrow night. We'll do that during the next segment. Before we do that, let's get in the list. Tua Tagovailoa. All right, Steve, we did get the official word today. It had been trending here all week. You could kind of tell the way that McDaniel was talking and We got the news from Tyreek Hill that he was crying when he had Tua in the huddle. I think that just shows, oh boy, that's the power of Tim Boyle as well as Tyler Huntley. But I think the thing that's fascinating is we know he's going to start. We know he's going to play. I'm fine with this. As long as everyone operated in good faith, the doctors signed off. I think we spend far too long trying to tell athletes not to play. And to me, it's like, I don't know what that would do to him physically. Like, he's been with football his whole life. Like, if he loves football and everyone operated in good faith, by all means, it's his life. He should get to do what he wants to do. I do wonder, though, quietly, do you think if the NFL would have had a vote, they would have voted for maybe at least don't play this year? Because it feels like now everyone's just going to be waiting for the first time that Tua gets hit, particularly in the head. Like, you know, you're going to have people come out and saying, is he wearing the Guardian cap? Like, we're going to get all the pre-written takes. But I've often wondered that, like, if the NFL had a vote, which way do you think they'd go?
As you're explaining that, I'm thinking about the family and where their vote is more than the NFL. Yeah, I mean, the NFL, everyone's in a situation, and it's Tua right now because everything's chronicled.
Yeah.
And it's been scary with him, not once, multiple times.
And most of at least two of the really bad ones have been on standalone games, primetime games, where everyone was only watching that one.
Everyone's there.
I always go back to
eyeballs are there.
The one before Cincinnati, and Dolphins fans will nod their head in agreement on this one. They played a noon game the week before, and Tua clearly got concussed in that game, but it was a noon regional game, you know, that gets lost in everything that happens at noon, and it's not a nationwide game. And then he goes back on the field, and I'm like, wait, what is he doing? Like, this is before, and then he gets the Bengals one, and that's what happens. But I'm just of the opinion, I think you're right. Like, I'm sure there are probably members of the family, particularly now that he's got the guaranteed money. But, like, at a certain point, it's like, I don't know, man. Like, there's certain guys that when sports get taken away from them, like, it takes a toll on them mentally, physically, like, changes their life. I'm not saying that football's going to end for him at some point, but it's like, I just can't stand this rush of, we should say when he stops playing football.
The quality of life. I mean, you're talking about his playing days, with which that window for every athlete, especially in the NFL, is small. But there's going to be another one. There's going to be another one.
I mean, almost assuredly.
Yeah. So nobody's going to let up because it's Tua.
Well, and it's
He gets hit.
It's interesting because Nick Saban was on McAfee's show today in between when I had the morning show in this, and so I heard him say this, because they were discussing Tua, and, you know, he had multiple injuries. He had the ankle, so he did the tightrope high ankle sprain surgery 1 year as a starter, and then there was another year where he, like, hurt his hip, like it was on the sideline. And Saban made the point, while the last concussion maybe doesn't necessarily fall into this, but more times than not, oftentimes plays where Tua gets hurt, it's when there's nothing there and he just keeps trying to make something happen.
Right.
Now, the last
you're never going to take that out of him.
Right. And I mean, to me, it's like the last one was, hey man, he was taking off to try and score, like that's a little bit different, but it's, I don't know. Like I'm sure Dolphins fans are like, have you watched our offense? Like if he says like, let's go, let's go. And I don't feel a particular way one way or another about that, but like I'm with you, like it just feels like in a sport like football, where I'm still not convinced that it was meant to be played by athletes this big, this strong, this fast, it just feels inevitable. And then it feels like we're gonna have another just barrage of takes,
right? And that everyone should have stepped forward. Where was the league? Where were these people? All those different things. These stories have played out time and time and time again. You brought up the Cincinnati one. I was on air. I was doing updates for ESPN Radio National, and as I'm going, music's playing, and I might have been in a soundbite or something. They're like, "Do not look at the screen right now. Do not address it. It's bad." And I had to stay tunnel vision right here, because if I looked in any other direction, I had monitors all over my studio. Came out of it, and they showed it one more time. Like, whoa! And you know, the host, I think it was Freddie Coleman, took it, which great. But there was nothing to say except that was ugly and this is not good. For this player individually, we're talking about one player right now. Every single player every Sunday is at risk. But with what he's gone through right now, and yeah, as you shared with Nick Saban, you're not taking that mentality away. He, you know, they're invincible in some way. And that's the mentality of, you know, we just love that. We just take it in and appreciate what they do. But I mean, we know where this goes. You know, once his playing career is over, quality of life. Was it Steve McMichael we just saw went to the Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
Joe
Montana has talked about how, you know, I guess he lives on a lot of property out in California somewhere. Like he has like a gun range and he's like, yeah, he's like every like seventh or eighth time occasionally, like I'll just miss. And it's like, I'm pretty sure it's like, I'll forget things from time to time. He's like, I'm pretty sure it's all just related to the number of concussions I had.
Right. Yeah. So to how you opened it up, Jeffrey, the NFL absolutely wishes, you know, we'll see you next summer. And you know, we'll, you know, take it from there, for the 25 season.
Yeah. And I mean, to your point also, I don't know if I really care what the league wants because they're so image conscious anyway. Like I don't think they do anything altruistically. I think they do everything.
They've got no fault. Correct. Right? They've got no fault in this because they haven't had fault with how many ever players have played in the NFL and have dealt with concussions, have dealt with, you know, all sorts of injuries.
One other thing I wanted to get into, we had Thursday Night Football last night. I don't know if you've noticed this. I think I've figured out the new identifier of bad ref crews in the NFL. So
you can do that because there are a lot.
Adrian Hill is one of my all-time least favorite officials. And I also throw this out. I'm the one guy that I'm someone that likes watching football on Saturdays and watching football on Sundays.
Right.
The college football fans that think like officiating is terrible the NFL fans that think officiating is terrible, it's like, come over on Saturdays and step on into this world. But the new identifier is, if you're watching a game and it feels like every single play you see an official go to the earpiece to have the replay assist, that tells you that the league knows this is not one of our best crews. It's on a primetime spot. Like, we're having to hold their hand through. And so last night with Trey Blake's crew, you get the obvious miss of the face mask on Sam Darnold. And listen, I think that game was going a particular way. I don't think it decided the outcome, but I think it's obvious, like, that play, whatever hope Minnesota had of winning, that it went out on that play. And like, I don't know. It just kind of, my whole deal is, I don't know where we keep drawing the line on replay assist, replay, what's challengeable, what's not. Because then the other thing, it's like, I thought the idea of replay assist was if a call was made, New York could come in and could help facilitate. It was originally designed to speed up the game. Like if they got a spot wrong by a yard or two, it wasn't designed to be the hand of God. The problem is when I watched it at night, like last night, and there have been other games, it's like I feel like they're trying to officiate the game from the replay center, and I don't think that there are... I think they have the right intentions. Like, we're trying to get this thing right and move it on. But it's like, doesn't that just miss the overall problem? It's like, if you have a crew that's this bad, like, why are you having to hold their hand? Like, I know officiating numbers are down. Like, to a certain degree, it's like, who the heck wants to be an official? I call high school football games. I can tell you, I don't know anyone that would want to realistically do that job. But it almost seems to me like you're the NFL. This doesn't feel like the right solution of trying to officiate the game from a command center in New York.
Right. And I mean, accountability of, you know, whether it's Major League Baseball or NFL, you know, ref officials, you know, if you're bad, you're bad, and your job should be on the line, you know, year, week to week, month to month, year to year. And they've got real, you know, I mean, you know, same crews, same officials, you know, with the bad reputations, they come back year in, year out. As you were talking there, I thought this is right now the way it is. Does the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, do they have the best system in place? It takes some time sometimes with the NBA, but I just feel like when they need to go to a call, And, you know, and again, sometimes it's coming down to just, I mean, just the most, you know, a ball off a finger.
Yeah.
You know, that knee down. You know, I mean, these are the best. You're doing this at the high school level and you're dealing with craziness. But right now, I feel like the NBA has a pulse on how to be the most efficient and how to get it ultimately right, which is what they want.
I think I agree with you, but you know what the irony is to me? They've cut down on replay. I mean, remember, like,
right.
now what it's the only time you can review is the last 2 minutes of each half. You can review off the ball. I think one of the bigger problems, and maybe the NBA has an advantage of this, because while player safety in any sport is always a concern, the NBA has not had to go to the lengths that football in particular has to write rules for player safety. The problem that I've really had with the NFL is that basically the league, to basically say, like, hey, not our fault, as we were talking about with Tua, they've added more subjective rules that I think make the game harder and harder and harder to officiate. Like, the more times that you are bringing in, you know, subjective checklists, like the hip drop tackle is the perfect one. Like, well, did it meet all five standards? Like, you're asking somebody to review that, like, to make a decision on that in real time. Like, and we slow it down. It's like, I don't know. Did he meet three of the five? Did he meet four of the five? I think the biggest problem that I keep seeing, particularly in football officiating, is we're adding more and more subjective elements to them to try and officiate, and inevitably it's going to be impossible.
That's the road we're down. We're not entering, or we're not getting onto that road. We're on that road.
Yeah.
Because it becomes unwatchable. You're taking a 3-hour NFL game and it's now 3.5 hours. I mean, we push games back to 4:25 because, you know, games were bleeding into each other, you know, from that 1 o'clock window, because of the stop. And, you know, it is, I mean, any game, I mean, I do not watch even close Saturday and Sunday to what you watch, but any game that I've, you know, hit on Saturday or Sunday, especially Sunday, it's like, or, you know, Thursday night's like, this is brutal. There's no flow whatsoever here. You know, we've already, you know, you've stopped it again. It's just
college is by far. Oh God. I mean, that's the other thing, is like, they've sped up the clock rules, and unlike the NFL, which at least can control the presentation of their product, they can dictate how many minutes of commercials. Well, the TV networks dictate how many minutes of commercials. So basically what we've done in college football is we've basically reduced the number of plays. And so the actual amount of game time has been cut down, but we still have more ads. And so it's just made it even worse. And then, you know, on top of that, in college football, you have the faking injury epidemic that you don't really see in the NFL. Like, I mean, it'll happen from time to time in the NFL, but not at the frequency that we see it in college football. It does make it a tough product to watch. All right, quickly before we get to Eric, wanted to get into the World Series. All right, Steve, I think this is interesting, because I don't know if, unless you're a Dodger or a Yankee fan, or if you're a Yankee hater, maybe a Dodger hater, this feels like the ultimate World Series of, like, I don't know who to root for one way or the other. Because to me, like, in a certain element, it's like the Yankees versus the new Yankees in terms of the way they spin, the way they operate. But I do think one thing that I do think is cool about this World Series is, in baseball particularly, it's very difficult to get the teams that have been the two best teams, or the team that's been the best team in each league for most of the season, to get them actually matched up. It's quite hard to do. And I think it's safe to say we've done that here in this World Series. But I also think there's kind of this other angle. And with Shohei and with Judge in particular, and I guess you can also include Soto and Stanton maybe to a certain degree, but it does feel like with Judge and Shohei in particular, winning this World Series, and maybe they'll have other opportunities, I don't know, it feels like it kind of changes the way that they're perceived. And I know far too often, I think I get kind of fed up with legacy talk and whatnot, but I do think either guy winning a championship puts him on a different level of how I at least think about him. Not that that means anything.
Yeah. It's going to be number one for either one of them, Judge or Ohtani, and those are your superstar sluggers right now. I mean, how many years have we had Mike Trout sitting at home with the Angels, not even in the postseason, and the best player in baseball? These two guys right now are the best sluggers. They're the biggest draw. They've, you know, kids, all, you know, I think more and more in baseball, you're rooting for individuals. And you're almost content on understanding it's how hard it is to get to the World Series. But here we are. It's New York. It's Los Angeles. They've spent all the money to get here. They've finally gotten here. There are plenty of people who have, you know, oh, they spent the money. Good for them. They didn't make it. Glad. Happy. But these are the two teams, you know, it's a tournament now. In the NCAA tournament, as much as we like the upsets in the early rounds, you still want to see the Blue Bloods.
Yes.
You want to see Duke, Kentucky. You know, I'm in the Northeast. Yeah, UConn. Villanova's been there. You know, where are the West Coast schools? The Big Ten schools. You want to see those schools in the Final Four. That's going to be your best basketball. You know, Brad Stevens and Butler. You know, Brad Stevens getting his teams there and, you know, almost winning. That's great. But, you know, baseball's got opportunity here. There are going to be eyes on these guys. And as I say before every World Series, and here we are, go seven, because there's where you're truly going to get the storyline of, okay, here we go. All the marbles, one game, one swing from an Ohtani or Judge can swing it in their favor and they win it. I want to say, hey, you know, I don't want slugfest throughout, but the way the bullpens and the starting pitchers are and how they manipulate this, it was probably good that they had all the time off between the league championship series, and now they've situated their bullpens. The Dodgers are going to be out without one of their big relievers in Phillips. But I don't want slugfest every game, but I do want Ohtani and Judge to be in the middle of the offensive explosions when their teams go.
I don't necessarily care about going seven, because what would annoy me is if we can get seven, but it's like we see this far too often in the NBA playoffs. Series will go seven games, and we had maybe like one game that was competitive. Like, right. I would take a five-game series if somebody won in five if we just had game pressure. Because the thing that I found kind of frustrating about the championship series is, like, so many of those games just felt inevitable. And
yeah, Mets,
it's like,
Dodgers, yeah.
But there's nothing I love watching more and fascinating more than playoff baseball game pressure. And it's like, if we get five games with game pressure, like, I'll sign up for that. But I think we're talking about the same thing. We just want to see, like, to me, it's like, what defines greatness is, what do you do when the pressure's on, when it's the hardest, when it's the stakes are the highest? Like, what do you do? That's all I care to see. Is like, I just don't want to see 8-1 games.
Right. Right. You'll take 8-6. I'll take
8-6. Yes. Yeah.
I'd love to see from a pitching standpoint, I'd love to see a 3-2, maybe. But then you're talking about, it's not the pitching necessarily. It's just an inept of guys not being able to put the ball in the play, and you probably got both teams striking out 10 or more times. But that could be drama-filled. You know, if a Judge strikes out with the bases full and two down an inning, that's drama.
Yep.
And that's what we're signing up for.
All right, let's take a quick break. We come back. Let's welcome Eric Hasseltine to the program. We'll talk Grizzlies next right here on Jeffrey Wright & Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. That music means we welcome to the program the Memphis Grizzlies Radio Network play-by-play announcer, Grizzlies and Rockets tonight, pregame at 6:30. Eric will have tip-off at 7. He'll be right back at it at home. The home opener tomorrow night against the Magic, 6:30 for pregame for that, 7 o'clock with Eric. Eric, we got our first opening look of night one. What'd you like?
Lots of things. I think that there were some really you know, I think there's some really good things to take out of it. I think there were some concerning things, but the pace is such that you can withstand a couple of stretches of bad decisions and you know, taking the ball out of the net when teams make a field goal or a free throw and kind of running it right back at them. Turns out that works too. So there was a lot of things there, and I think, you know, I was a little frustrated with some of the things that were let go by the officials, especially towards like Zach Edey. I thought it was clear John Collins hooked him like three times right in front of an official. I'm like, you cannot hook a guy's arm like that. And why call a double foul? But that's going to happen. And I don't think Zach didn't lose his cool, but obviously he didn't have the best of games. That's not the way he would have liked to begin his NBA career. He would have liked to have done a little bit more, I think. But that's part of it. And so, There was a lot to like. You know, Ja getting into Ja mode, I would have liked to have seen that earlier. But, you know, look, Jay Huff comes off the bench and buries threes, and you got other guys making plays. I think you see when Jaren comes back, and then you have Gigi and Vince and the guys that are in the normal rotation, Luke Kennard, that this is a fairly deep roster. And so a lot to look for there. I think Utah is a little better than people think. They got a lot of young players there. They don't have a true point guard nor a superstar to kind of bring it all together. But that's a tough building to go play in. So to get a win on the road is it's impressive. And Santi certainly was a big factor in that too. So, I mean, there was a lot to like, and there was things that are obviously going to have to be cleaned up.
What do you expect from tonight? Because the Rockets, on the one hand, it's like, you know, it's been you know, we got the Dylan factor, but also they lose to Charlotte night one. You got to think that they're going to be mad as hell, if you will. Like, I do think it's an interesting test for the Grizzlies tonight.
I think they're going to be pissed. I mean, I don't think there's any two ways about it. And they let a second half disaster kind of dictate their opening night. And I don't want to call it a disaster. It's game one. But first of all, Charlotte's going to be better. They just are. A healthy LaMelo Ball, having Miles Bridges, Brandon Miller another year into it. They really like the young guy they got out of France. And look, they've got some players. They're not going to be your typical Charlotte Hornets of the past couple years. Their coach is very good. He's had high levels of success as an assistant. So this is not a guy that took the job and is coming in to go, okay, well, I'll just take this for 3-4 years, collect the check, and get out. He's trying to win. Charles Lee's trying to win. So I don't want to put anything past what they did, because coming back from double digits, as many as 18 on the road, is not easy, especially on opening night. And they did it. Now, what does that beg in terms of what Houston has? They're not a lot different, Jeffrey. Like, I'm doing my prep work for this game. I didn't have to change a whole lot to the board, and it was a 41-41 team last year. So, Reed Sheppard's a great player, third overall pick. Does he make you 5 or 6 wins better? Maybe. If Steven Adams is healthy, does he help in, you know, increase that 5 or 6 wins? Maybe. But they're still kind of the same group with Van Vliet and Jalen Green and Dylan Brooks and Jabari Smith Jr. and Alperen Şengün, and not a lot behind it. You know, Tari Eason's a nice player. I don't want to knock that. Steven would be a nice piece coming off the bench, unless they put Şengün at the 4, which I don't see that. Shepard adds a little depth at point guard, but they have Aaron Holiday, and I didn't think he was bad. He's not the number 3 overall pick, but there's not a lot new here that you go, oh, yeah, I can see that. I can see that being a huge uptick for them. So there's concern here in Houston that they're kind of just treading water, that last year they should have been maybe 43 or 44 and, you know, 38, 43 and 39, but that wasn't good enough to get you in the play-in at that point, I don't think. I think 46 got you in or 45 got you in. So are they good enough? We'll see. So I do expect them, though, to you know, this is a team that played really well on their home floor last year, that didn't blow a lot of fourth-quarter leads, and they did both of those things. They didn't play well, and they blew a fourth-quarter lead. Although it had been 18 in the first half, it had shrunk to 4 by the start of the fourth, and the momentum was clearly on Charlotte's side. But tie ball game late, LaMelo Ball makes a shot, and the Rockets don't. So I think they have some decisions moving forward. They really do. They've kind of hitched their wagon to Van Vliet and Dylan for a couple years. Şengün is a really good young big, but what's Jalen Green in the NBA? You know, when he came out, people thought could win a scoring title. I've watched the young man play. I don't see that. I see him being a bucket getter, but a little undersized, defensive liability. Is he a guy you build around? Is Jabari Smith Jr. the guy you try to help fill that role of a third player? Is Reed Sheppard that guy? But, I mean, they've had they haven't gotten much from Amen Thompson yet because of injuries. He's got potential. Like, they've got to figure some things out. There is a point where some of these teams that have gone through rebuilds have too many young guys and not enough spaces for them. And those young guys are things people around the league covet. So do you move them, try to move, package them together and get a star, or do you move one for a complementary role player that really fits what you do? That'll be up to Rockets front office, obviously. But I think the Grizzlies look good today, you know, watching them in morning shoot around. I think they know that this is going to be a tough battle. The Rockets took, you know, 3 out of 4 last year from them, won both games here in Houston. The Grizzlies have not traditionally played very well, other than that stretch after James Harden left, where the Grizzlies just dominated the Rockets, and everybody did for that matter. They were perennially at the bottom of the league, but it's a weird deal, and I'm not trying to speak ill of Houston fans, but I don't get the sensation that when the Rockets aren't awesome, that Rocket basketball is as big a priority as, say, Astros baseball or Texans football. It's kind of the third wheel here. And even when they were really good, when people knew they didn't have a chance to win a title, or in their minds didn't think they had a chance, that there were plenty of fans disguised as empty seats. And that doesn't happen in a lot of places. So I don't think this is some massive home court advantage. And for the Grizzlies, boy, if you get this one, you come home on a high 2-0 against a really good Orlando team who didn't just beat Miami. They punished Miami in every way possible in that game. On the glass, in transition, from the arc, defensively. I mean, Miami got hit with bombs from them, whether it's Franz Wagner or Paolo Banchero. So you got a real tough one tomorrow night. So this is going to be interesting to me, how Taylor Jenkins manages the minutes, dictated by how the game goes. If you fall behind big, does he pull the ripcord? Do you save it for tomorrow night? Or do you think you can get back into it? Because Charlotte just proved this team can be prone to giving up a big lead. They were up 18 and they lost to a Charlotte team that literally nobody has making it into the play-in tournament that'll be in the lottery again. Although I see them potentially being one of those dark horse teams that if they catch the right groove, they might sneak in that play-in tournament. They might get up to 8. I don't think they're a top 6 team, but they've got some talented pieces, and if they're healthy, they can be dangerous.
Eric, you mentioned Edie and the officials the other night. You've seen him summer, preseason, one regular season game now, so there's a little bit of a chalkboard and a little bit of scouting on him a little bit. But do you anticipate anything beyond the normal growing pains for Zach Edie when it comes to his rookie season?
I anticipate teams trying to engage him in physical play, thinking that as a young guy that has done this in college and kind of been the star and maybe gotten the call, that he engages back. And as a rookie in the NBA, when referees don't know your style, you're going to get that called against you. I think there's a lot of people that want to prove he's not a top 10 pick. You know, the narrative on him, and it's unfortunate for the young man to me, because like, what has Zach Edey done wrong? Why are people so down on him?
Yeah.
Because he's big, because he's 7'4", and you know, now at 290, because he's lost weight, he wanted to get in better shape, and that's been a big point of contention. Like, they had him listed because when he got to weigh-ins and all those physicals, he was like 299. And he went to people and he said, hey, look, I'm not 299 anymore. I've lost 10 pounds. I worked really hard to lose those 10 pounds. I want people to say I'm 289, I'm 290. I don't want to be 300 because it gives this connotation of you can't move. But, like, what has he done wrong? The guy played hockey and baseball growing up. He picked up basketball late. He gets to Purdue. He works his tail off to become a viable player in college, keeps working harder, and becomes a multiple-time National Player of the Year with multiple awards, the first guy since Bill Walton to sweep all of the National Player of the Year awards for back-to-back seasons. And then everybody says, oh, he can't play in the NBA, though. Tell me why. Because the game's fast and people, instead of running to the basket, now run to the three-point line. I'll still take a guy that's 7'4 and 290 and can move a little bit and can protect the rim. I don't have a problem with that. So I think it's a lot for a young guy to go through to hear what you aren't and what you can't be rather than what you are and what you can be. And so I think for him it's a mental challenge. And I saw Ja during the first game a couple of times go to him and just go, hey, man, forget it. Like, just move on. We have 82 of these things. And, you know, you're going to get a lot of this in this first year until you just let it roll off your back and go dunk on somebody. I mean, I remember the classic story of in Magic Johnson's first game, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar hits a game-winning shot and Magic just goes bananas. And the reason they called him Buck was Kareem looks at him and goes, hey, young Buck, we got 81 more of these this year. If you keep jumping on me like this, I'm not going to make it through 50 of them when we win. And, you know, that was just Magic's exuberism and youthfulness coming out, where a veteran stepped in and said, hey, understood, we're all excited for the win, but it's one win, and we got another one in two nights. So I hope that's kind of what gets into Zach's head, is just be Zach Edey. Don't let what pundits or experts or other players or coaches say about you even remotely affect you. Just go out and be the guy that this team needs you to be. Set big screens, roll to the basket, be confident catching under. He had a catch under in the game in Utah where I thought he kind of just hesitated just enough where then he couldn't get a shot. And then he tried to float it up, and it looked like what should have been a goaltend, but the referee said, oh, he wasn't shooting it. I'm like, you're right. A 7'4 guy 2 feet from the basket drops a ball towards the rim. He's not shooting it. He was just trying to throw it to the ground. Are you an idiot? Come on. Like, let's get serious here. But they don't see these guys that often, so I get it. I get where they thought that might not have been a shot attempt, and he, like, oh, you know, he dropped the ball. But he's going to have to battle through it. And I think he will. I think he's got the right people around him to help him. And I think, you know, I was pleased to see Ja, like, kind of go over to him more than once and just say, hey, relax, it's good, you're fine. Don't pick up a cheap foul running up the court. That one bothered me, because when you're a player that's getting called for that, when a guy hooks your arm and you just kind of run and he's hooked your arm, so you close your arm, why is that a foul on you? The initial foul was the hook of the arm. That is totally illegal. It's against the rules in every way, shape, and form. And John Collins intentionally did it because they had been jawing, because Zach got pretty physical with him on a play. And we kind of picked it up on the court. Mike, I didn't go over the radio where he's like, hey, man, like, ease up, Rook. And Zach Edey's like, hey, man, you know, like, what do you want me to do, not play? You know, kind of thing. There were some choice words in there that we can't say on the radio. But then Collins gets all upset. Ja stepped in. Collins tried to say, it's cool. But the very 2 seconds later on the free throw, he hooks his arm. And I mean, hooks it and pulls. John Collins is a strong guy. You can do some damage to somebody's shoulder with that. And so Zach just kind of clamped it and ran, and James Williams called a double foul, which I think is a chicken move. Who hooked the arm first? John Collins. Foul should be there. And if John Collins complains, well, he's clamping my arm, well, then don't hook it. You hook it, you get the foul. And I hope that gets better as we go along and referees get used to seeing what this guy is and how people are trying to negate the advantage he has with a natural gift of size.
Eric, good luck this weekend, my man. We'll be listening.
Looking forward to it, brother. How did MUS do last night?
We won on senior night, Oak Haven 42-14. The big one is Briarcrest next week, and that's for the right to not have to travel the first round of the playoffs.
Well, I wish you guys all the best. I've got friends at Briarcrest, too, so that's tough. But I'm sure you got home and saw the egregious non-call against Sam Darnold as well, which begs the question of how do you not see that with two officials? So, I mean, we're talking about officiating here today. Obviously, that's the big elephant in the room. And for a lot of people that maybe follow you in your way to try to sports invest, mm-hmm. Maybe some props where Sam Darnold was only like 4 yards away from going over.
Well, and, probably wrecked some teasers as well.
Oh, I would think so. Yeah, I would think so.
Definitely did that. All right,
never mind. I guess we can grab the face mask now. Let's do it.
No, because you didn't see it. You didn't see it. That's what I said. It's like, okay, what were you looking at?
I don't know how you did. Yeah, I don't know how you did. His neck turned 90 degrees the wrong way.
All right, bud. Good luck.
All right, see ya.
That is Eric Hasseltine. I want to remind everybody that golf, or I should say October, is Golftoberfest at Birdies. That means you can book online and enjoy half off standard golf rates all month long. If you're going to be celebrating Halloween, they got a costume contest going on tonight or tomorrow. Wear your best contest. You'll get judged. We'll find out who the winner is on Sunday. Also, karaoke night tonight on Simulator 2 and tomorrow night, 7 p.m. until close. All the information at golfatbirdies.com. Also, follow them on Instagram at birdies901. All right, Steve, for today's Don't Tell These Story, Tell Your Story. This was one that I had to read a couple times because I'm still not quite sure exactly what Dame Helen Mirren meant. This was her story when she was on an interview with The Standard. I always say it's so sad that Kurt Cobain died when he did because he never saw GPS. GPS is the most wonderful thing. To watch my little blue spot walking down the street, I just find it completely magical and unbelievable. Okay, timely.
It's 3 days in a row I've heard Kurt Cobain's name. Thank you for extending the streak.
Yes, there we go. There's 3 for 3. All right, buddy, I appreciate you being with us.
Thank you.
He is Steve Lennox. If you missed anything, it'll be up on the podcast shortly after the program ends. For Dennis, for Steve, this is Jeffrey saying thanks for listening. Keep listening. The Gabe Kuhn Show is coming up next.